In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
People need to kind of wake up, and we need to start having a deep philosophical discussion on what money is and who it represents. And if the state is issuing money, then that money more or less represents either the crown or the type of government or the people issuing the money versus a private monopoly. So this is the key point here. I don't even like to call monetized debt the system that most countries are under now. I don't even like to call monetized debt money. I think it's a facsimile of money, and it's two very different things.
If you enjoy Conspiracy Unlimited, why not become a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member? For just $1.99 per month, you'll gain access to two bonus, exclusive, commercial-free episodes per month, plus access to my back catalog of episodes. To subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Gain Access to Premium Episodes. Again, go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes, or click on the link in the episode notes. Conspiracy Unlimited Plus for less than $2 per month. Why not sign up today?
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
We are going to embark on a discussion, probably the most important discussion one can have these days, and that has to do with how we got to where we are. And where we are right now is on the precipice.
of worldwide depression. We just seem to continuously avoid the problem, printing more money, devaluing currencies, and so forth. It's all very complicated, but it's all very vital to understand, and we're going to try and do that right now with our next guest. He is a recognized scholar whose credentials include a PhD in philosophy from the University of Oxford. How about that? Oxford. His literary contribution is a veritable resume unto itself, covering such fields as Nazi Germany, sacred literature, physics, finances, the Giza pyramids, and music theory. He's a renowned researcher with an eye to assimilate a tremendous amount of background material. He's able to condense the best scholastic research and publication and draw insightful new conclusions on complex and controversial subjects, and we're going to talk about that right now. And we're going to go back to one of his earlier books. It's called Babylon's Banksters, The Alchemy of Deep Physics, High Finance, and Ancient Religion. What do all of these things have to do with each other? We're about to find out. A great pleasure to welcome back Joseph Farrell. Hello, Joseph. How are you, my friend?
Pretty good, Richard. Thanks for having me back on.
A recent conversation with Marilyn Magruder Barnwald about Leo Wanta and the missing $27.5 trillion, a story I'm sure you're most familiar with.
Well, sort of. I've been so busy that I've been kind of submerged and underwater. I just finished the sequel to Babylon's Banksters last Wednesday and got that off to the publisher. So I've been kind of out of the loop, but, you know, no amount of missing money these days. It would be a surprise.
Indeed. Obviously, within an hour, we don't have time to address a lot of the nuances, but how did we get into this problem where we are, I guess, starting in 2008 with the subprime collapse? How did this start? Who's responsible?
That depends on where you want to draw the line. And obviously, from the title of the book that we're discussing tonight, I tend to draw the line very, very far back in history. And it really begins, I think, in ancient times when you see the rise of, for want of a better expression, an international bullion brokering class, all right? And this is very important to the story. It's very important for people to understand what I'm about to say, because if we trace that story forward, you can trace it literally from ancient times forward into modern ones in a fairly unbroken chain of concepts and methodologies, all right? And this is the key to the whole question. Back in ancient times, we have to deal with one general kind of basic phenomenon regarding the bullion trade, and that is that the East, the Orient, tended to value silver more highly than gold, whereas the West tended to value gold more highly than silver. Now, obviously, that's kind of a generalized cultural expression. We're not talking about regional market conditions or anything of the sort. But once you understand that, then you see something begin to happen. Back in ancient Sumeria, money, for all intents and purposes, was a debt-free instrument that was issued on clay tablets as a receipt on the surpluses of the state warehouse. In other words, it was a receipt, if we want to put it in modern terms, on the gross domestic product, on the gross national product. So it was essentially circulated debt-free, but it was circulated by the state and in connection with the temple, with religion, all right? This is where the story kind of begins, because you see this international bullion brokering class attempting to replace those kinds of receipts with something that has the ability to be traded internationally, and that, of course, is bullion. Once they set up their trade, then you begin to see a connection between these bullion brokers, between the rise of slavery, because you have to have slaves to mine the bullion to make the coins to pay your armies. So in other words, you start to get into kind of the ancient version of the military-industrial complex, you know, a never-ending cycle of slavery and bullion trade and so on and so forth.
But, so that didn't begin with the end of the Eisenhower administration. It goes back a little bit further.
Believe it or not, you know. So, you know, what this does in effect, Richard, is on the local scale, it means that this class of people attempt to drive out these, for want of a better expression, these kinds of debt-free credit instruments, bills of exchange and so on, effectively what some of them were, and to replace them with coinage. So you see the rise of coinage during the what Karl Jaspers called the Great Axial Age in from about the 8th to the 4th century B.C., depending on where you look. But
Because a gold coin was transportable, you could move, it was mobile, you could move it from country to country. And also, because when you had debt-free money, that's very limiting for empire building.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So you see the rise of this class. Now, if we jump forward a bit, you see them during the High Renaissance and the High Middle Ages. You see the same sort of thing. You see a bullion brokering class, and it's particularly focused and fixed on Venice. But again, you see this attempt to manipulate the bullion trade between the Orient and the West, and Venice was just extremely practiced at this. It was able to manipulate gold or silver gluts or famines depending on the way the market was blowing and whose currency they wanted to undermine. So this is not a new story. If we bring it forward into modern times, I think then you would have to look at, first of all, the attempt by Abraham Lincoln to break the back of this private money class that had a monopoly on money issuance, of course, during the Civil War, and even earlier than that with Andrew Jackson. And to bring the story forward to modern times a bit more, you have a similar sort of thing being practiced by Hitler and the Nazis and inside of Nazi Germany. And to a similar extent, or in kind of a similar way, you have some of this going on with communist China. So there's this big tug of war. And I want to be very clear here, Richard. There needs to be a philosophical discussion about the nature of money and who should be the power that issues it. I'm certainly not in the central banking camp. But there's a number of people out there now advocating, you know, a return to some sort of modified bullion standard. Well, my point in writing these books is that this is how the rise of that class got started. It's not a magical cure-all. In other words, we need to take a very long historical view.
No, not, yeah. In other words, you're arguing against going back to the gold standard because, well, who's controlling the bullion? Who's controlling the gold? The
exactly.
Same class that instituted these central banking systems around the world. In the U.S., it's the Federal Reserve.
Right.
The Bank of England. And this is the class that wrested control of the issuance of currency and the printing of money away from the state,
right?
And so we no longer have debt-free money.
Right.
They create money literally from thin air and then charge interest, and that's how they make their untold wealth. So, yeah, not a return to the gold standard, but a return to debt-free money.
Yeah, it's a discussion I think we need to have. You know, the attempts to return to that in the past have been either more or less successful, depending on the example you look at. Of course, it was done in China, you know, in very, very ancient times. And of course, like many governments, they ended up inflating their currency and you know, having numerous currency recalls. But on the other hand, it's important to note that during those periods, the ancient Chinese economy was fairly flourishing. So what I'm really trying to get at here, Richard, is people need to kind of wake up and we need to start having a deep philosophical discussion on what money is and who it represents, all right? And you raise a very important philosophical point here. If the state is issuing money, then that money more or less represents either the crown or, you know, the type of government or the people issuing the money versus a private monopoly. So this is the key point here. I don't even like to call monetized debt, you know, the system that most countries are under now. I don't even like to call monetized debt money. I think it's a facsimile of money, and it's two very different things.
Indeed. And you mentioned those periods in history when a regime has tried to fight back against a system. You mentioned Nazi Germany, and you're
yes.
careful to point out in your book that here was this murderous criminal gang, the Hitler and
right.
his henchmen, the Nazis, and you know we've documented their crimes against humanity. But all the point you're making here is they had at least part of the equation right, that they were
right.
fighting to wrest control of the issuance of currency. But certainly that does not forgive anything that they did. But there's obviously more to that story. There is a connection between money,
right,
and as you call it, deep physics, the alchemy of deep
yes.
physics. Well, let's talk about what was going on in Nazi Germany, for example.
Sure.
You've
sure.
talked about the Nazis' pursuit of free energy. And I just want to crib a couple of paragraphs here quickly from your book, Joseph.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about Nazi Germany, physics and finance fully rationalized.
Mm-hmm.
This relationship between finance and physics was, in modern times, first clearly perceived by that nation which not only established state credit or state-created debt-free money, but which also sponsored a variety of secret research projects into free energy physics and technologies. Nazi Germany. You go on to point out that most people are aware that various private financial powers in the West, the Rockefellers, were instrumental in placing Hitler and the National Socialist Party into power in Germany. We've talked about that previously on the program and
right.
and Prescott Bush and so forth. What
right.
most do not realize is how quickly Hitler turned on his backers and refused to play ball by the same old Rockefeller rules. So now that Hitler has complete autocratic authority,
mm-hmm.
he does something, as you point out, that American greenbackers could only dream about. Take total control of the economy, which
right.
meant what in terms of the banking establishment?
Well, the Nazis do two things. The first, as you read there, was they created a system of debt-free money. All right, they were called Seder bills, or in some cases, MIFO bills. But they were essentially kind of the German equivalent of an American United States note. In other words, a piece of paper that was circulated debt-free directly by the Treasury, all right, with no central bank involvement whatsoever, and therefore it was interest-free. The other thing that the Nazis do, and this is quite the crucial point, is that they began a number of very, very secret projects during the period before the war, and they continued them throughout the war, and in my opinion, continued some of them after the war. That's, you know, that's another part of the story. But what they did, Richard, was they were attempting to find new sources of energy. They were quite literally attempting to make Germany energy independent. And that meant, of course, that they had to find new sources of energy that were not requiring petroleum and therefore beholden to sources that were more or less exclusively in the hands of the very same Western bankers, all right? Now, in my opinion, they were relatively successful, at least in coming up with prototype technologies to do this. You mentioned free energy, and I think what they were trying to do was essentially find a technology that would allow them to tap into what quantum physicists call the zero-point energy. And there is indication that they may have had some sort of success, albeit very halting and kind of preliminary in that. But we can kind of get a glimpse as to why this would be upsetting to the banking powers because of the way they treated Nikola Tesla, who was essentially trying to do the same thing. We all remember the story of J.P. Morgan, of course, shutting down his project on Long Island to beam electrical power anywhere in the world.
For free, essentially, because you want, if you can,
yes.
yeah, because you
right.
can't meter it if it's going through the air.
Right, right.
Well, we need to point out a couple of things here. One, I need to understand, our listeners need to understand, what is the connection between issuing a debt-free money and free energy? Because one would, it's almost counterintuitive. One would think that if
yeah.
you have a fiat money system, and you have fractional reserve banking, so that you can, you have unlimited credit. In other words, you can print money, you know, till the cows come home, which is what we have now.
Right.
That would allow you to dump. I mean, we have black ops projects that are dumping, you know, untold billions and billions, maybe even trillions of dollars into research projects.
Right.
So if you go back to a debt-free currency issued by the state, how does that allow you to pour money into free energy projects?
Well, the connection really is in the conceptualization, and this is where I think many people get led astray as to what I'm really talking about here. Debt-free money issued by the state is essentially an open system. In other words, the state issues money in response to market conditions. All right, that's the key here. If there is need for more money in circulation, you do it. If there's need for less, you do it. The central banks, on the other hand, perpetually inflate the currency and therefore devalue the value of currency. In other words, you're dealing with kind of a zero-sum game. You have a certain X amount of limited resources, and that's certainly true of energy. And this is why I mentioned energy. It's certainly true of energy. So as you inflate the currency, the cost of energy in terms of the units you have to pay in that currency for it goes up, and the value of your currency goes down. This is not what the Nazis are doing. What they're trying to do is they're setting up a currency system that allows them to expand the credit of the state, while at the same time they are pursuing energy systems that are not locked into this scarce resource, non-renewable energy resource system that we have now. So in other words, they're taking double aim at the whole structure of the system. That's the key crucial point that people have to understand here. And again, one of the things I'm trying to point out, Richard, in Babylon's Banksters is that this whole association of finance and physics, it really is very, very old. It really kind of boggles the mind just how old it is, but it's definitely there. And you see it, you're going to see it. I just kind of want to give people a heads up about the second book in the series. You're going to see that association between physics and finance emerge very, very clearly during the High Middle Ages and the Renaissance. You're going to see it very, very clearly.
Okay, the other thing that we need to point out about Nazi Germany, lest people think that, you know, we're holding Nazi Germany up as a model.
Oh, no.
Because the important thing to point out here, too, is that while they were essentially thumbing their nose at the international money power, of course, the fatal, horrible mistake that they made was to identify as world Jewry as being at the center of this international monetary system. And of course, that we know where that led, to the Holocaust. But they were correct that there was an international money power.
Sure.
But they might as well have also sent Protestants to the gas chamber, because there were just as many Protestants. Okay, so there were some Jews that were involved in banking. So there were many Protestants that were involved in banking.
Right.
The international money system is not a Jewish conspiracy.
No.
Okay.
It's a matter of class, and this is where, you know, so many people run astray. But, you know, my whole point in writing this series is in part, Richard, to combat this idea that you're dealing with kind of a monolithic religio-racist conspiracy against the rest of mankind.
Exactly.
Because certainly when you turn back the clock and you look at things like Babylon or Egypt or Imperial Rome, or then later, you know, Venice or Genoa, Florence, you're certainly not dealing there exclusively with international Zionism. You know, the last time I looked, the Medici's and the Borgias and the Contarinis were not part of that crowd.
Exactly, exactly. Well, thank you. That's very important to point out, and we thank you for that. So, by unbridling oneself,
uh-huh,
or unyoking oneself,
right,
from the international, monetary powers,
right,
you now have unlimited debt-free money to pour into things like free energy.
Right.
So,
right.
So there is kind of this two-prong, those are the two huge issues obviously facing us today.
Exactly.
Are crippling debts and energy security. So,
right.
But is there, I guess what I'm not getting is the connection between these bankers and, I mean, do they have this class of international monetary or these international banksters? Do they have some secret knowledge regarding free energy?
Oh boy, Richard, what a question! that really opens up Pandora's box, and I don't really directly address that question in Babylon's Banksters. I kind of hint at it. I definitely directly go after it in the sequel to Babylon's Banksters. So I'm going to crawl way out on a limb here and advise people that my answer is in part exceeding the evidence that thus far I've argued, all right? But my guess is, yes, they do. They do have some sort of secret knowledge that at least indicates enough to them. I'm not saying it's complete or exhaustive knowledge. I'm simply suggesting that they have some sort of knowledge that indicates that there is a very, very different kind of, if you will, physics or cosmology than we have been taught publicly. And that physics or cosmology is intimately and directly tied to the type of financial system that could threaten them. After all, let's turn the clock back and go back to what I said at the beginning of the interview. When we start this story, we're starting out, contrary to almost every economist will tell you, we do not start with barter systems. We start this financial journey with credit instruments, all right, with what's debt-free money. Then we move to coinage, to bullion. Then later on, we reintroduce credit instruments in relationship to that bullion, and basically the modern system comes out of that occurrence during the Middle Ages and Renaissance. So in other words, I do think that they had some sort of knowledge, because if you turn back the clock and go back to those countries that did have these types of credit money systems, Sumer and China and so on, they also had a very interesting cosmology. They had a kind of idea that the physical medium is a very fecund information-creating medium. In other words, it wasn't really, in a certain sense, a zero-sum game, as it is for modern physics. And therefore, they didn't have kind of a zero-sum economy either. So all of this is tied together, and my real point in writing these books is to get people to turn back the clock and look at how deeply interconnected these concepts are with each other.
No, it's interesting if you go back into American history,
yes.
And you had those who were advocating, people like Hamilton, who were, yes, advocating that the American adopt a central banking system because it would make available to them unlimited credit so that they could build, for example, I guess it would have been the Erie Canal.
Right.
And these huge, you know, these huge projects.
Right.
And then you had others, was it Van Buren that Alexander, fought in a duel?
That was actually Aaron Burr.
Aaron Burr. But he, you know, so you had the other side, they were arguing against central banking. And of course, we all know what Jefferson said about central banks and so forth.
Exactly.
So you had this titanic struggle, but the argument was always, without a central banking system, you can't have these huge projects. We wouldn't have the capital available to us. But what you're telling us is no, that's not the case.
It's not true at all, because again, you had very huge projects taking place in Nazi Germany that really boggled the mind. Now, of course, the black part of that project is that it was not only funded in part by this sort of credit system, but by a massive program of looting. You know, wherever the Nazis' armies went, they were looting and pillaging, and then, of course, on top of all of that, they added slave labor. So you had, you know, this is something that most people don't appreciate, but you had an enormous black projects bureaucracy inside of Nazi Germany. This is why they were able to pursue so many and so widely divergent, almost kooky projects in some cases of secret weapons research. So, you know, it's not true that this needs to be the case. I think the bottom line, Richard, is that those who are advocating this kind of central banking scheme are simply in it for themselves. They're in it for their own power at everybody else's expense, because it's a tremendously empowering sort of system that they always set up.
Joseph Farrell, Babylon's Banksters. When we'll come back, we'll talk about how a number of countries today are fighting back against this international monetary power system, and some of those countries, interesting, they've been sort of vilified in the mainstream press. I'm talking about countries like Russia. Could there be a connection? Perhaps we'll discover that when we come back.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily, wherever you cast your pod.
Hey, tis the season to give the perfect gift. C60 Evo Organic Oil Elixirs and Facial Serum Sets. And here with another sleep tip is our good pal, Chris Burrows, co-founder and chief scientist at C60 Evo. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Richard, thank you so much for having me. My next tip regarding getting better sleep is related to electronic devices. So we all have these, this cell phone lying around, or we're using it on a regular basis. What a lot of people don't realize is that those devices give off blue light. That blue light is actually tells our bodies, the only time naturally that we see blue light is at the peak of the sun. So when the sun is up at its peak at noon. And so what those devices do, including your computer terminals, your cell phones, your tablets, is they convince our physiology that it's the middle of the day. you can imagine that if you're watching your cell phone or tablet at 10 p.m. and you've somehow convinced your physiology that it's the middle of the day, this is not good for sleep. So it's really important. Most devices have actually blue light blockers, and you can just go out and Google and, you know, how to blue light block on my Samsung device or Apple device. Or even on your PC or your Mac. Make sure you turn that on. I know people who leave it on all day so that they're never impacted by that blue light. I would recommend 2 hours before the sun is setting in your local area to turn that on. Obviously, it doesn't work if you're working on videos or you're working on pictures, but try and turn that on 2 hours early. And the other thing regarding electronic devices, try to keep them out of the bedroom. I recommend that you actually put a charging station outside of your bedroom so that you just don't even bring it in your bedroom. These devices, as we've kind of been reading and hearing, are like geared to trigger our endorphin responses. And so we like to be on them. They keep them up. So keep it out of the bedroom and make sure you got your blue light blocker on about 2 hours before the sun sets. And I always like sharing sleep tips, because our most consistent testimonial for our product is that people take it in the morning, they report mental focus and energy during the day, and then better sleep that night.
C60 Evo products deliver noticeable benefits to people and pets around the world. Immunity boost, deeper sleep, just like Chris said, more energy, mental balance, flexibility, and longevity. Please visit the website c60evo.com/Richard-Serrett. And don't forget, use the coupon code EVRS at checkout, EVRS at checkout, and then you save an extra 10%. That can't hurt. All right, Chris, we'll talk again next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
The truth goes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Then it is violently opposed. Finally, it is accepted as self-evident.
Let me just read that again. I don't know what that means.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
And Dr. Joseph Farrell is with us. His website is GizaDeathStar.com. Giza, as in the pyramids, G-I-Z-A, DeathStar.com. GizaDeathStar.com. And I've lost count how many books you've published, but the Giza Death Star, the Giza Death Star Deployed, Reich of the Black Sun, the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, the Cosmic War. I think that's when I sort of caught up with you, Joseph, around 2007. Secrets of the Unified Field, the Nazi Internationale, the Philosopher's Stone, Babylon's Banksters, which we're discussing tonight, Roswell and the Reich, LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, The Grid of the Gods, and you're currently working on three books, all due out later this year. Thank God you have time to do this show. I don't know when you sleep, Joseph, but I have to crib from your book, Babylon's Banksters. We talk about what's going on in China, and it's just booming, their economy. They're just cleaning up at the Olympics, and there's obviously a connection there. But you point out here, there's a little-known aspect to China's booming economy that Western financiers, economists, and media mandarins are loath to discuss, and that is that China's money is created by China, not borrowed from private bankers. And then you go on to point the irony, this the idea that they're making debt-free money. This is they've taken a page right out of the American federal constitution.
Right. Richard, you're opening up such a huge area of discussion with China and their money system that, you know, it really behooves us to spend a little time with it. Because this has huge geopolitical implications. For the moment, the Chinese currency, the renminbi, is pegged to the dollar, all right? But what we're seeing and what we've seen happening in the last few years as the West and the American empire, and there's no doubt in my mind that it has to be qualified as an empire now, as it has overstretched itself and just become brutal and reckless with its wars and covert operations and so on and so forth, there has been a quiet reaction taking place geopolitically in the world between the two chief Asian powers, which would be, of course, Russia and China. They recently announced that they were going to conduct their bilateral international trade directly in their own currencies and not peg them to the dollar. All right. This was a huge, huge thing. And this has now extended itself to similar deals with Iran, India has indicated that it wants to consider some similar arrangements. There have been quiet moves in Japan that preceded the Fukushima disaster, which I think are related to it, that the Japanese were attempting to enter some sort of rapprochement with China. This has huge geopolitical implications. Now, here's why this idea of debt-free currency is so very important and why it has, I think, the oligarchs of the Anglo-American elite a little panicked. If you're dealing with an economy like China's, of the size of China, with a debt-free currency, this means that China can go to nations like Libya or the Sudan, think Darfur here, folks, and offer them essentially debt-free money to improve the infrastructure of those countries. And this is precisely what the Chinese have been doing. In other words, they can beat the terms of the International Monetary Fund, which is basically a sock puppet for American geopolitical interests. They can beat the terms of the World Bank. They can beat the terms of all of those central banking institutions, in other words, that are basically shills for Anglo-American foreign policy and geopolitics. This is why you see, in response, the United States in particular, but sometimes in conjunction with its NATO allies, expanding its bases around the world and stepping up covert activity. Because under the system that we're under, quite frankly, we cannot compete in terms of the value of money. The cost of our money is too high. That's the bottom line. So this has huge, huge geopolitical implications. And, you know, the more the West tries to tighten the noose around China, the more you see the Asian powers, India, China, Burma, Indonesia, Russia, and so on, drawing closer and closer together. So this is a huge story. This is the financial aspect behind what's going on. And there is underlying the financial aspect, Richard, a geopolitical aspect too. And people need to understand that as well with respect to what's going on in Europe right now. There's
sure.
an underlying...
Even Syria. I mean, you connect the dots.
Sure.
All those countries that are aligning now with the BRIC countries...
Right.
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Right.
They become targeted by NATO, the United States, which have become essentially the proxies or the
right.
bully division for this international money system.
Right.
Now, it's interesting when you, again, we're connecting the dots geopolitically
right.
to, you know, the current financial system. And... we were talking about China. And you mentioned
yeah.
Libya. China was
yeah.
making debt-free money available to Libya. And Gaddafi, shortly before the insurgency happened, and it was, I'm pretty confident, an outside insurgency that
oh, yeah.
was disguised as some sort of a civil war.
Yeah.
But he was looking at sort of forming a Pan-African debt-free currency, was he not?
Yes, he was. He was. And it was precisely in order, again, to break out of the chokehold of the Western central banks. You know, that cluster of banks, central banks in Switzerland, the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, the World Monetary Fund, World Bank, and so on and so forth. All of this was being done. And it was, I think, to a certain extent, Gaddafi was acting a little bit as China's cat's paw. So we're, in other words, looking at these smaller countries acting as proxies for the big players behind the scenes. And I agree with you, Richard. There is no doubt in my mind that these uprisings across North Africa and then on into Mesopotamia have been staged largely by the West, because they follow that familiar pattern of similar uprisings that were in Kosovo, the so-called Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. All of these things are, you know, they fit the tactic that we've seen the West developing and perfecting as a means of covert warfare against regimes that it does not like. And the key that they're using it's informative to note, is human rights. You know, they've turned human rights into a weapon of covert operations. And I caution people not to buy into this, because, you know, the West, and particularly the United States, supported in the last decades since the end of the Second World War, some horrendous dictatorships that, you know, had horrible human rights records. They've simply changed the game, but the name of the game remains geopolitics, and it remains finance. And the real bottom line is the competition between two very different philosophies of money. That's what's still the bottom line after all these millennia.
And in Russia, they too, I mean, Putin has, are they now issuing debt-free money? They don't have a central banking system there, do they?
No, I think they do. And that's an interesting question that I really don't know the answer to, Richard. I think that in Russia's case, we have a bit of a different situation. I can tell you this, that if you view Putin as a kind of a neo-Stalinist or an authoritarian, in other words, if you buy Western propaganda, you're really not understanding what Putin is about. He comes out of that long tradition within Russia of more or less Russia for the Russians, and his moves against people like Khodorkovsky and so on and so forth have been moves against the Russian oligarchs that were playing ball with the Western central bankers. In other words, Putin is acting against those people. And it's of a piece with his pronouncements that he's made ever since 2007 at, you know, those NATO conferences, where he was very firm in warning the West that it was clear, as far as the Russians were concerned, that the expansion of NATO was to do nothing but encircle Russia. And again, I think he read the situation exactly correctly. I think that's exactly what the West was up to. The whole game has been about dominating those energy supplies in the Eurasian heartland, and the inevitable result of that attempt to dominate those supplies and to emasculate Russia was simply to create this reaction now that you referred to earlier, with the rise of the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China. You know, that is an extremely powerful bloc, and it is not a bloc that the West ultimately can stand up to if it stays together.
So do you foresee then this current monetary system that we have that's saddling us with, well, it's enslaving us is what it's doing.
Yes.
Do you see this nearing collapse?
Oh, yeah, I do. Now, how that collapse is going to come, you know, I'm not a financial advisor. I do want to caution people. I'm simply, you know, a hack from South Dakota that's looking at a certain interesting set of dots and trying to connect them.
A hack with a degree from Oxford. Come on, Joshua.
Well, but nevertheless, a hack.
Hardly.
But I do see it happening. I don't see the current system, in other words, as surviving without some drastic radical change. But the question really is how that change is going to come about. And we need to add to this factor something else, Richard. And I referred to Venice earlier because the second book in the series is largely about that period of history and about Venice. All right. At that time, the world was going through one of those periodic 500-year cycles of change. Now, we happen to be entering a similar period. In other words, we're at the beginning of another one of those 500-year periods of cyclic change. But the difference now, Richard, is that this period is unlike anything previously in all of human history. The scale of it far exceeds anything that we've been through before, and the depth of it and the breadth of it, both technologically, philosophically, economically, culturally, everything is happening at the same time. So we have to factor this into the equation, because it means that these financial oligarchs in London and New York City and Washington and so on, these oligarchs are factoring all of these things into the equation too. And this is why I think you're seeing definite signs of desperation and panic amongst them, because they are clamping down as fast as they can on what reserves of power base that they have left. And that's kind of scary to me.
Yes, they're not going to give this up without a fight, obviously.
No, they're not.
So this could be a very bloody transition from the old system to the new one. And I guess the question is, can we ultimately survive it given what's at stake?
Well, I've said before on other shows, and it bears repeating here on yours, Richard, that we're entering a situation where we could be looking at, a kind of global version of the 30 Years' War from, 1618 to 1648 that occurred in Europe. And, that was long and protracted, quite bloody, and ended up bringing in or kind of ushering in the modern era. So we're looking at a similar period with similar possibilities. And it is interesting in that context to note that the American military has been making noises in its publications that this is precisely what they see ahead. They see a prolonged period of protracted conflict, regional conflicts taking place all over the globe. And it's all part of this contest now between the geopolitical realignment in Asia and what's left of the West. The key player here for the moment, at least as far as the West is concerned, is going to be Germany. And this is why I say behind the European crisis you have a lot of geopolitics. And I think it's being engineered simply to try and maintain Germany within the Western camp and prevent any sort of direct rapprochement between Germany and Russia and China.
Is it possible? I mean, I've heard rumblings that given the sinkhole that is now the Eurozone,
right,
that Germany, keep in mind that the billions that they've poured into Greece,
yes,
the hundreds of billions of euros they've poured into Greece, and yet, the world can't cobble together $2 billion to alleviate, starvation in,
exactly,
in Western Africa. It's absolutely abhorrent.
Yes, it is. I agree.
But is it possible then that Germany is going to say, enough is enough, we're going back to the Deutschmark, and the rest of you people are on your own? And that Deutschmark might be debt-free money.
Well, again, yeah, I just saw a poll today, as a matter of fact, right before I got on your show, that, and I don't remember what the poll was, but apparently something like 71% now of Germans think that it would be a good idea to get out of the Eurozone. So in other words, the only thing holding Germany in the Eurozone are the financial and political oligarchies in that country. If it were up to the German people right now, they'd be gone. And in a certain sense, it's only reasonable to see why. Germany's largest trading partners are in Asia. Germany draws most of its energy from Russia. So in other words, it's in the German national and geopolitical interest to have closer ties with those countries. There's little else keeping Germany in the Eurozone other than its, common European culture with the rest of those countries. But you can't expect the German people to go along forever and bail out everybody else. Their economy simply isn't big enough, and nor is anybody else's for that matter. So, you can't blame them.
What would happen to a leader? Well, I think I know the answer, and we've seen this played out in history repeatedly, but what would happen to a leader of a country, let's say even a presidential candidate, who would declare that we are going to return to the federal constitution and that the Congress shall be responsible for the issuance of debt-free currency? Ron Paul has certainly hinted at that.
Right.
Assuming that they could get elected, which doesn't seem likely, but what would happen to that candidate?
Well, I suspect you would see the same thing happen to them as happened to the other two presidents that tried to do that, namely Lincoln and Kennedy. They're stone cold dead. I suspect you'd see the same thing. The only president that was not successfully assassinated that did that was Andrew Jackson. And of course they made several attempts on his life. So I think, for this to happen, it's really got to be a different approach. It's the people of the countries, in your country and certainly in mine that need to wake up and realize what these oligarchs are and what they've been and what they've been up to. In other words, the oligarchs need to be brought to the point where they realize that they've lost their people. And at that point, they're in the same position as the communist apparatchiks were in the Soviet Union before the collapse. They can press all the buttons and move all the levers of power, and nothing happens.
Indeed, yes. As Lenin once remarked, my hand is on the steering wheel, but I don't seem to be driving. I don't know what's happening. Well, and if you're not in the United States or Canada, and you try to do that, then they'll say the West will claim that you have an active nuclear weapons program, or that you're cozying up to Al Qaeda. Right. They'll find some excuse. To bring in the NATO airstrikes. All right, Joseph, listen, we anxiously await publication of part two of Babylon's Banksters, and just about anything else you're willing to drop our way. We're just okay. waiting at the edge of our seats for your next book, and always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me back on, Richard. Been a pleasure.
Joseph Farrell.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.